faces a choice. This is Battleground America. Here's Tara Servatius.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Insane Things Podcast, where we only run down things so insane we've never seen them before. In a world where the Insane Thing Podcast can be done as normal every week, well, it speaks volumes. Let's dive right in. Insane thing number five, the death, suddenly, of Lindsey Graham. No long hospitalization, just he was there one day and then gone. Kind of reminds you, jarringly, of your own humanity. I think this is why the story was as big of a deal as it is. If he'd checked into the hospital, lingered there for a while, well, it would be the way of things. He's 71, after all. I didn't love Lindsey Graham at all. In fact, I'm still and have still been engaged this week, as I have been in recent weeks, trying to destroy his machine, which has done so much damage in the state of South Carolina. But if I can say one thing about Lindsey Graham, I'd say this. I've always admired his ability to hang on. A little over a year ago, Lindsey Graham was polling at 41%, and Breitbart even wrote that he was in trouble, because he was, for a sitting senator to be polling at 41%. But sure enough, he figured his way out of it, got the Trump endorsement a year early, that cleared the field, and off to the races he was. But I want to read you this quote from Lindsey Graham. I absolutely love it. It's the kind of thing I'm going to be thinking about 5 and 10 years from now. It's from The Atlantic. The writer, Rich Fontaine, wrote, "The stakes reminded me of a question I once asked Graham on a long flight over Central Asia. At what point in his career, I wondered, had he gathered the boldness to assert himself so overtly in foreign policy? Quote, when I was first elected to the House, he recalled, I looked for the they who run things, they who know how things really work, they who know what they are doing. But I couldn't find the they. After that, he went on, I went to the Senate, but then there was still no they. And then I started to get invited to the White House and to closed door briefings and to meetings with top officials. No they. What I finally realized, he concluded, is that there is no they. There is only we. And we don't usually know what the fuck we're doing." It probably, in all fairness, didn't seem to Lindsey Graham like there was a they, because he was part of the they. And they usually weren't up to any good. In Lindsey's world, they was we. But the big takeaway from this, and my husband actually read that quote at our dinner table to the kids, as an example of one of the life lessons he's taught me, don't give people too much credit for being smarter than you are, better than you are, or having it all figured out. Don't assume, he told my kids, that because somebody has a higher position than you or more money, that they're actually competent, because you'd be shocked to find out how they're not, even at the highest echelons of, well, anything. It's something he reminds my kids of often, and me too, and it's good to be reminded of it. Don't let other people intimidate you. They really often don't have it figured out. And that's what Lindsey Graham is admitting here. He thought once he got into these holes of power that these people would be smarter than him and better than him and have it more figured out. And the big reveal is they're not. And once he finally realized that, he got bolder and bolder. It's a great life lesson for you to take with you, no matter what organization you're in, no matter what part of life you're doing. And my husband, of course, turned to our boys and said, by the way, the same thing applies to women you're dating. Don't give anyone too much credit. The danger isn't that you'll underestimate your competitor most of the time. It's that you'll overestimate them and never get started off the firing block. Boy, have I found that to be true in life. Insane thing number four. The Democrat Socialists of America just released their platform. It starts with this. Imagine taking a day off from work in a future without capitalism. You work as much as you are able, but no more than needed. And right away, the glare of what's not there, what's missing, is obvious. if the future has no capitalism, how does that happen? Is it simply outlawed? It's going to be great, though, they say, because you're not going to have bills. Speaking of bills, the Democrat Socialist of America platform says you don't really have them anymore. You have no debt. You don't need health insurance. You don't pay a mortgage or have a landlord because comfortable housing is a human right. Your retirement's publicly funded. Food, education, energy, medicine, transportation aren't for-profit businesses. They're common goods and utilities. Folks, they're actually promising people they won't have bills. And they're not lying about that. I explained that this week on the show, and I didn't understand it fully till I read the book We the Living. I've told you for years that it's probably the moment that changed my life politically by Ayn Rand. Because Ayn Rand is one of the few human beings to escape the USSR, one of the few human beings that lived there both before and after the Russian Revolution, and saw how quickly things change. And this is correct. Under communism, you will not have bills. But what they don't mention is that capitalism, private transaction, will be illegal. Everything will come from the government. And I did not fully understand this until I read We the Living, how those societies really work. We have vague ideas of this in America, but we don't really get it. Well, in We the Living, everybody got a ration card, and everything from soap to toothpaste to clothes to food came from the government. But there was a catch. Those things always ran out before they got to the end of the line. Life itself became a struggle then to stay in the front of the line. Because if you had to trade for those things, barter for them, that was illegal. Remember, there's no trading, no bartering, no capitalism. It would land you in the gulag. And if you went to the gulag, you weren't coming back. They'd work you to death. So the goal was always a better place in line. And the only way to get that better place in line was to increase your value to the party. Folks, this is what you spent every waking moment of the day doing. It wasn't enough to merely be a good, compliant little communist in order to get to the front of the line. No. You had to volunteer in your free time doing things for the party. It might be reading books that praise communism. It might be knocking doors. It might be actual labor. They would fall into bed at night exhausted as families, having never spent any time together because everybody was so busy volunteering to get a better rating. Getting a better rating meant getting a better job. And of course, your job is what determined your place in line. And folks, I've always assumed that the reason that they were able to control so many people was fear. And yeah, fear was a part of it, but I assumed it was fear of, them showing up in the middle of the night and dragging you out back and shooting you or something. They didn't have to do any of that. In this system, people spent almost every waking moment, including what was supposed to be their free time, working for the party, trying to improve their rank so as not to wind up at the end of the line. And the way Ayn Rand describes it is truly terrifying, wanting always to kiss the rear end of the communists, the petty dictators in charge, at the not very good job that she had for fear that she would lose it and have to get a worse one, which would mean then she would be required by law to be at work, but there wouldn't be anything to eat once she got home. It's through this simple system that they controlled every moment of every day of your life. And folks, when it says you don't have to pay a mortgage or have a landlord because comfortable housing is a human right, oh, they'll give you housing, all right. They'll take everybody's house first. You're already seeing Ma'am Donnie do this in New York. I did a podcast on it talking about confiscating rental property. Well, Ayn Rand's dad owned a pretty nice house. The Communist Party took it, but generously allowed them to continue living as an entire family in just one bedroom. They had to share the living room and the bedroom with complete strangers, some of whom were criminals and quite frankly terrifying. The party just moved them in. See, these are the kind of details they don't mention in the Democrat Socialist of America platform. But what they do tell you is what they intend to do. Eliminate the Senate. Eliminate the presidency. Have the remaining house which would be the House of Representatives, Congress appoint an executive who would answer to them, abolish the courts, set up their own court system, again, a court system that answers to them, where no one ever questions the way they want cases to turn out. Instead of co-equal branches, the courts here, weighted with Congress, again, the courts would be under Congress. But folks, that's where you get the show trials that you saw in the Soviet Union and in Cuba. This isn't even socialism, folks. This is poorly repackaged communism. What's even crazier is that before this platform was actually published, in other words, before voters actually knew what these people stand for, 36 of their candidates had won nationwide at the state legislative level or higher. Insane thing number three is a story I've spent a lot of time this week on because it shows exactly who the Democrat Party is. It started like this, and you've probably heard about this. An illegal immigrant, child rapist, rapes a 10-year-old for over a year, is completely unrepentant about that, and is ultimately scheduled for deportation back to his homeland of Laos. This is a guy who says it's not fair that he's the one with a criminal record. He thinks the 10-year-old should have a record, too. After all, she participated in it. He calls it a minor crime, unironically, like no pun intended. Well, Minnesota has a 3-person pardon board and the governor sits on it. Well, he and two others, including the attorney general of the state, voted to pardon this guy because he was facing an automatic deportation because he's an illegal immigrant. In order to save him, Tim Walz votes to pardon him. In part, he says, so the guy can stay with his kids. Yeah. He's got 6 biological children now, 3 of whom, horrifically, are girls. If you're thinking that must be the insane thing, no, it's not. The insane thing is that after Marco Rubio managed to deport this guy anyway, Tim Walz, and folks, you almost have to really see the video to get this, Tim Walz wasn't faking it. He was genuinely baffled as to why Republicans would want to get rid of this guy. His body language conveyed it. He just can't understand. And folks, he doubled down on that this week. He first said it on June 27. He just couldn't understand why on earth you'd want to send this guy out of the country.
In this case, I would state this, that I can find no reason how Minnesota will be safer or better if Mr. Vang is deported to a country he has not been to since he was a child.
Again, you can't see how Minnesota would be safer, folks. He can't see it. Okay, but look at this statement here. No concern of any kind for the victim. No concern of any kind for future victims. No, all the worry is for the comfort of the illegal alien who has been in America since he was little. And well, God, poor thing, how will he get along in Laos? Well, that was back on June 27th. Here's Walz, and this is really where you see this body language. He genuinely doesn't understand Republicans. He cannot figure out why we would want to deport a child rapist. He was so upset about this, he doubled down again yesterday.
While speaking to the news media today, the governor was asked about the 42-year-old father's recent deportation.
Did that make us any safer? Did that make the children that are left behind any more stable? Did it improve the idea that we can't all be judged by our worst day?
Can you hear the bafflement in his voice? He genuinely doesn't understand Republicans' thinking on this. And folks, judged by our worst day? This guy sexually abused this girl, including intercourse, for over a year. I really gotta wonder, folks, is this guy attracted to children? Is that why he can't process what's wrong here? He's clearly got a screw loose, and it shows you how loose the screw of the Democrat Party actually is. Think about it. This guy could have been the vice president of the United States of America. But folks, a party this tolerant of child rape is suffering from a general moral malaise so profound that they obviously are going to be fine with other crimes. And the crime we're finding that they're fine with isn't just rape and murder and all the things they release illegal immigrants back into our communities after they do. You know, folks, if you're okay with those things, than if the right people rob the American people blind to the tune of $500 billion a year. That's what Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent put his estimate at, $500 billion worth of fraud a year. Well, folks, it just fits. I mean, if you're okay with child rape and say, well, it was just the worst day of his life, hey, pardon him, let him go. Folks, stealing $10, $15, $20 million from federal taxpayers is not a big deal. I mean, if Tim Walz doesn't bat an eye over a child rapist, pardons him so he could stay, and then he's baffled when Rubio sends him back anyway, he's going to be double, triple, quadruple baffled when somebody's upset about the $9 billion in fraud minimum that we now know happened out of Minneapolis with the complicity of Walz and the attorney general there. I mean, it's just not a big deal if the right people rob all the wrong people blind, if you're already in the tune of, hey, there's virtually no crime we can't forgive. And you saw that this week, something virtually unthinkable a decade ago. Big fraud hearing, Rand Paul in the Senate. The Democrats no-showed. A few members of leadership were there right in the beginning, and then when it was clear it was starting, they walked off. In protest of what? Folks, I've been doing this almost 20 years. I've never seen Democrats completely vacate a committee hearing unless they're protesting something. Well, what are they protesting? The idea of fighting fraud? The Democrat Party of 10 years ago would a wink, wink, nod, nod, laughed their way through this, all pretending to be very concerned. They were smart that way. They were crafty. I mean, folks, what even is the message of this?
Senator Scott.
Chairman, wouldn't a Democrat go next since the Republican just testified?
If there were a Democrat here, yes.
So there's no Democrats present at a hearing about fraud?
There doesn't appear to be a great deal of interest across.
Senator Bernie Moreno couldn't believe it either. They're not even going to pretend to oppose fraud?
I think preventing fraud in government should be completely nonpartisan. It's not a Democrat issue or a Republican issue. Yet almost the entirety of the Republican dais is filled with people sitting here listening to the entire hearing. And literally the entire Democrat dais is empty. I think that's, quite frankly, a disgrace. I think it's a disgrace to the people who pay taxes to know that there's an entire party that does not care whether taxpayer money is burnt.
Folks, what's the message to Americans here? What should we take from this? What's their reason for not showing your pro-fraud, I guess? You want it to continue because it works in your favor? You oppose anybody who questions it? And folks, it tells both Americans and the fraudsters, if Democrats get in power, they can do it. I mean, folks, I'd love to be a fly on the wall and just hear their discussion when they all decided en masse not to do this. I mean, what did they think? It would send the wrong message to fraudsters if they showed up that they're serious about cracking down now? Because most of the fraudsters, as we know, I mean, they're Democrats. In Minnesota, for instance, they're Somalis who bundle votes for Democrats. Are Democrats afraid if they're seen sitting at these hearings that the vote bundling will just continue and people will go home? They'll have to make a living. They'll be afraid. I don't know, but you can count on this, especially after them doing this. They get back in power, it's on. And you and your wallet are what's for dinner. They're going to let this fraud go. They will be absolutely AWOL when it comes to stopping it. They will allow their friends, maybe even them, to rob you and the American taxpayer blind. This is a matter of policy for them now. And they're on the other side of fraud. The, hey, it's okay with us. And besides, if you question it, you might be a racist. Or at very least, an oppressor. Insane thing number four. Trump's speech last night. Or rather, the fact that he had to give it at all. Longtime listeners of this podcast know almost all the details of Trump's speech last night. The Chinese hacking, the Iranian hacking of our boards of elections, the use of that data to create fake driver's licenses, 19,000 of which we caught going through Chicago O'Hare, the whistleblowers who've gone to the FBI and warned, hey, China and Iran, but mainly China, are trying to steal the election for Joe Biden. They're going to use mass absentee ballot fraud. Here's how they're doing it. And then the FBI, Kash Patel telling us, scraping that off, wiping that off their servers, shutting down those interviews and closing the whole thing, closing down the investigation and then lying to Congress about it. Because remember, the UK had, you know, they had their boards of elections hacked by the Chinese as well. So members of Congress were very concerned, said, is that going on here? And of course, our intel agencies knew damn well it was. Particularly the FBI went to Congress and stone cold lied. Incredibly, to protect China. It's not a news story. It's been dribbling out for months. And I've posted Just the News. I've posted Tulsi Gabbard's Twitter feed. I mean, you can go see all the intel yourself. What is insane is that Trump had to give this speech last night to reset because it's gotten no traction. What was new last night was the scope of it. The number 220 million. The fact that China is building what essentially is a shadow national voter roll, national database that it can use to manipulate our elections on behalf of the Democrat Party, which, you know, not coincidentally, is increasingly being taken over by the Chinese Communist Party. And the scope of this system, this parallel system, is staggering.
Over a period of years, starting during the 2020 election cycle, the People's Republic of China carried out what is believed to be the largest compromise of election data in history, resulting in China's illicit acquisition of 220 million U.S. voter files. That information includes names, addresses, phone numbers, political party preferences, and other sensitive data that would be needed to register to vote and engage in other nefarious activities, which is exactly what was happening. This data loss presents an unprecedented election security nightmare. The intelligence even shows that China has signed a data exploitation unit specifically to this new project.
That our intel agencies would actively cover up the Chinese hacking, lie to Congress, lie to Trump, who was then in office, to allow it to continue. As bad as we know they are, it's still almost unfathomable, but it happened. John Solomon with Just the News reporting this morning that Trump's speech was vetted by his personally appointed FBI, CIA, and DNI directors for accuracy. It's all true, all supported by the intel.
Compounding the travesty, the second set of documents we are releasing reveals that members of the deep state, very, very famous group of people, many cases, in our intelligence agency work to actively suppress and downplay information about the extent of China's sinister election meddling, covering it up from both the president and the American people like nobody thought was possible.
Think about it. These intel agencies knew and hid it so that it could go on.
U.S. spy agencies began learning about the compromise of voter registration files in 2020 when they discovered that tens of millions of voter data, think of that, tens of millions of voters' data in 18 states have been bought, stolen, or hacked by China. Yet those responsible for sounding the alarm instead kept the information secret and hidden. They did not disclose to me as president or to anyone else. And to the best of our knowledge, they did not inform Congress. In fact, all they kept saying is, this is the most secure election in the history of our country. A standard, very pat line that was divvied out to say. The cover-up of this colossal security breach is even more disturbing in light of the addition.
But this, folks, is so jaw-dropping. It makes Watergate look like child's play. Can you imagine if Watergate had happened and the media, most of the networks, had simply blocked it out and gone about their business?
These are exact quotes from the CIA reporting. Raw intelligence obtained by the FBI in 2020. Yet buried by rogue bureaucrats, stated that China's activities even included an attempt to manufacture illegal ballots for Joe Biden. Documents show that during this period, dozens of significant CIA and NSA reports about China's election targeting were kept out of the presidential briefing. These were briefings I would get almost every day. Everything was kept out that was of importance. One email among intelligence analysts admitted that they had, quote, deliberately massaged the presidential daily briefing to withhold information regarding Chinese activities related to the election.
Perhaps one of the most stunning details here, and it's not a big one, but it shows you the self-awareness of the deep state. It's a little section of an email that was declassified. It's from one of the managers within the FBI. And the beginning of the email, she's routing true intelligence about, you know, the Chinese hacking, Chinese election interference, through specific channels to keep it from being discovered by Congress and the president. And she's joking that she's part of a shadow government, folks. You actually want to see that email. I'll attach it in the sources.
Another official inside the FBI wrote that she was running, quote, a shadow government, unquote, to keep intelligence about China's election meddling from becoming known and to keep it away from the honorable press. Other officials who witnessed such efforts perceived the motivations to be blatantly political.
Insane thing number one. All those Trump officials standing around begging the Western world at that press conference, are good for them, for a worldwide war on left-wing terrorism. There's something striking about them. The fact that almost every one of them has either been the victim of an attempted assassination or has had to move their family onto a military base because they can no longer live among the regular American population. Stephen Miller is one who's had to do that. So is Marco Rubio. Then you had Scott Bessent talking about his, our Treasury Secretary, his own assassination attempt. Folks, there's no parallel of this among the Democrats. We're not trying to kill them. But there is a significant movement among them to kill us. And think about it, folks. That most recent White House Correspondents' Dinner, and that wasn't just the Trump that was the target. They intended to mow down the whole cabinet, almost all of which was there. And then that was followed weeks later by the UFC terror plot, where they were going to mow down MAGA supporters. But folks, this is now an every month to 6 week thing. All, of course, while the media pretends not to notice any of it. Here's Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent.
But I'm going to remind everyone in this room and all the media that I was the subject of an assassination attempt February 2024 by an addled left-wing activist 2 hours after being sworn into my job. So any of you who want to report that this is a fiction and does not exist, be there for the sentencing this August.
But it was Secretary of State Marco Rubio's speech that truly is the most insane thing this week. One of the best definitions of who the left and who left-wing terrorists actually are that I've ever heard. And I study the enemy for a living.
Through intelligence and information sharing, through coordinated law enforcement strategy, through financial targeting and disruption, we will dismantle these networks brick by brick. It is time for the people of the civilized world to defend ourselves, to stand united against this encroaching darkness and fight for what is ours. It is easy to destroy great things. It is far more difficult to make them. The enemies of civilization are only capable of the former. They are only capable of destroying great things. All they know is destruction. But we have built great things together. We have done it time and again. We know what we must do. And now we must do it. Thank you for coming today.
And then he said this.
This is a distinctive and unique evil. It has always been driven by a hatred. Above all else, a hatred for civilization itself. It is a revolt of the worst against the best, a revolt of the weak and the cowardly against the strong and the good. It is perpetrated by those who cannot build, who cannot create, who cannot achieve great things, and take their revenge upon the world for their own inadequacy by seeking to destroy those who can. This is what radical leftism is. It may wear various different slogans and ideologies across place and time. They can call themselves anti-capitalist, or anti-imperialist, or communist, or anarchist, or Marxist, but the fundamental character is always the same. It's always the same. It is a poisonous resentment cloaked in the language of equality and justice and liberation, an overwhelming need to tear down what greater men have built, to wreck what is beautiful and what is right on behalf of people who are only filled with ugliness and have nothing else to offer the world. Through violence and through terror, they once again seek to impose their ugliness on all of us. The old dogma was wrong. The old dogma was wrong. None of this is driven by idealism. It is not utopian. In fact, it is the opposite. One of the criticisms you sometimes hear of communism, for example, is that it sounds good in theory, but it never works in practice. That's actually not true. Communism does not sound good in theory. The world it envisions for all of us is small, flat, gray, leveled of all exception, drained of all that is good and noble in the human soul. The world it envisions is a world without courage, a world without creativity or ambition, a world without heroes or glory or great causes to strive towards, without a world without miracles, without myths, without men who rise above the rest to do incredible and extraordinary things. And the world communism envisions is a world without God. For these architects of revolutionary violence, the towering achievement of our civilization, for them, it's an unbearable humiliation, a reminder of what they cannot do, and a reminder of what they cannot be. So they choose instead to destroy. They attack pipelines, they attack railroads, they attack power grids and laboratories, the physical embodied symbols of power and invention and achievement. This is the nature of the terrorism we face today. They despise the West because the West is great.
Terra Servatius. Please subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Share with friends, family, and other free thinkers. Thanks for listening.